obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
Please help me welcome Frank C. from Los Angeles.
Hi, everybody. My name's Frank, and I'm an alcoholic. Carlin, thank you. That was excellent, and I had a great time here. You made me laugh, and you made me cry. It was great. My sponsor used to say, he said, if I'm really in touch with the truth of my sobriety, I'll walk around on the verge of tears. And that's what happens. When I hear you share, I hear you get in touch with the truth of your sobriety and it moves you. You know, I can't handle it. I can't handle the truth. If you're new and you think I'm moving funny up here, you're seeing things. What do you need, a drink or something? No, I kid the newcomer. My sobriety date is December 20th, 1982. So that's 5 days before Christmas. And you gotta be really sick to come in here 5 days before Christmas. Because it's free that time of year. That's my alcoholism. I have two progressive diseases. And about 15 years ago in 1998, I was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease. And it is, you know, Parkinson's is the least of what is wrong with me. But if you're new, you're not crazy. I do move funny. I dance while I talk. It ebbs and flows, it comes and goes. I'm not in any pain, I'm okay, and it's, like I say, it's the least of what's wrong with me. It will not define who I am. Alcoholism, on the other hand, I'm here to talk about my primary problem. I heard your story, Carlin. I never drank in high school. I never drank in college. I never went to high school, and I never went to college. It's kind of a funny story, too. The way I found out I had Parkinson's, I wanted to finish this. I had to go to a neurologist to have this diagnosed, this Parkinson's. And this is a story that, to me, is just one more piece of evidence. There's so much evidence in the program that there's something connecting all of us. There is something that's going on here. It's a secret. I'm still looking for it. You know, it won't completely present itself to me, but there's something going on here. And you stick around this fellowship long enough, you'll find out in short order there's a mystery here. It's a grand secret. It's great. But when I was, this is one of those connectivity or connection stories. You know, when I was diagnosed with Parkinson's, I was referred to a neurologist. Now, a neurologist is the type of doctor you got to go to have Parkinson's diagnosed, and they gave me his name on a piece of paper, and I thought, there's only one way you can pronounce this guy's name. You know, His name was Dr. J. Jerkowitz. I mean, I couldn't believe it. You know, I thought somebody's playing a joke on me here. Because you look at this and you thought, there's no other way to pronounce that, you know? I was hoping that I had it wrong. You know? When I went into his office and I said, Jerkowitz, I was hoping he'd come back and say, that's not my name, you know? Who could have a name like that? You know, and man, they said they loosened the top. I got it. Okay. I'm an alcoholic, man. I can handle this. I can manage this bottle of water. I know how to drink, man. I can drink. Just keep looking. Now, for the committee next year, I can tell you what kind of water not to get. That's the flimsiest bottle I've ever drilled. I mean, that was... We'll make it work, though. It was... I can... It'll be fun to watch me drink it, you know what I mean? Anyway, yeah, his name was Jerkowitz. He's renowned. He went to the Einstein Medical School in the South Bronx. His name is Jay Jerkowitz. I walked into his office. I sat down. He said, what's up? I said, well, my hand moves when I'm not moving it. So why don't you tell me what's up? You know? First thing he asked me, doesn't know me from Adam. First thing he asked me, he says, how does it respond to alcohol? So I guess what it is, my hand needs a drink. Hell, I could have told him that. I paid him $500 for that piece of information. There was no money tree that week, I'll tell you. But that's, apparently, you know, a test for Parkinson's. It's how it responds to alcohol. So I said, well, you're going to have to find out about it. Not giving me that test, because it's not good for you, for me to drink. Yeah, it's not good for you. I mean, I'm very grateful. I want to thank the committee and all that were involved in having me come and speak here tonight. I mean, it is an honor and a privilege to be able to participate in AA. Any way that I can, AA is, you know, hearing Carlin speak tonight put me in touch with how useless I was when I got here. Speaking is an opportunity for me to remember, you know, what a useless person I was. I describe it as a dog on the freeway. A mad dog in a daze. Yes. I was like a dog on the freeway. I had, you know, I was useless. I lived in a very hostile world when I got to AA. When I came to AA, the world was a very hostile place. I saw it as a dog-eat-dog affair. I was out to get mine before you took it away from me, and I was convinced that what you were about was taking mine away from me. That perspective, that kind of perception, renders one useless. It made me useless. I had nothing to give, and if I had had anything of value, I wouldn't have been interested in giving it. not in the world I lived in. It was just, it was a lonely, isolated place. When I got to AA, that's who I was. And I was useless. Anything that I have that's of any value, anything I can see myself to be, any sense of self, but most especially anything I do that's of any use to anybody, any service I render on this planet is a result of Alcoholics Anonymous in my life. It's a result of this fellowship introducing me to the big book. And if you're new and you don't know what a big book looks like, you can find out. I don't think I have one up here now. But you'll find out you want to get one of those. Because in that book, there are 12 steps. And the book was there to introduce me to these 12 steps. And the first 11 words of the last step, the first 11 words of the 12th step, were having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. And my sponsor was quick to point out to me, he said it was the only thing I was working on. He says it doesn't say a result, doesn't say some result. It says the result of these steps. It's the only thing I'm doing here is to change this perception of mine, is to have this spiritual experience. And then once that happens, you too can walk around on the verge of tears. Because that's what will happen. You won't be able to handle it. That was my experience. I mean, once I had had a spiritual experience, I no longer had to ask, what was the spiritual experience? You know, I mean, it'll move you, you know, and it's available to all of us. And that's what, that's a debt I'll never pay back. You know, what AA has done for me, it's been quite a journey. You know, Carlin mentioned a part of the book called The Doctor's Opinion. When I first got here, you know, I had a problem with the G word. I couldn't handle the spiritual aspect of the program. Now, there's only one aspect to the program, and that's spiritual, you know. So, you know, I was in trouble, you know, when I got here. But I had a problem with the G word and anything that had to do with spirituality. I wanted nothing to do with it. I blamed God for a lot of bad things when I got here. Well, in this doctor's opinion, which is it, so it took me 2 years to read the first 164 pages of the big book, which is a part with the directions on how to work the steps. Well, you know, in the doctor's opinion, which was a foreword, it was a preface to the main part of the book that Carlin spoke of, in that doctor's opinion, they didn't talk so much about the God thing. They talked more about the disease of alcoholism. It was written by this doctor, and I read that, and I thought, I can relate to this. You know, this was, it had some good stuff in there, and there was a line in there that said, any message that is going to hold the attention of this class of drinker must have depth and weight. You know, I love that, you know. My ego was such that I heard that and I thought, yeah, man, you want to hold my attention, you better be deep and heavy, man. So, I think that's at the core of us not being a glum lot, really, because I was asked to tell this story. I mean, I usually hate speaker meetings, you know. I can't handle it. I can't sit there, listen to one guy get up there and run his mouth about himself for half an hour. I mean, I just think, you know, just shoot me now, you know. I hate speaker meetings. Unless I'm the speaker. Then I have a pretty good time. You know? Well, similar to what Carlin was saying about not being marriage material, you know, I too was a blackout drinker. I'm going to get this down. It's a good thing they don't videotape these things. How would you like to explain to that newcomer that he's not drunk up there? Holy moly. Well, I too was a blackout drinker, and I was not parent material. I did not come to AA and learn to be an adequate parent, okay? I came to AA because I had loose teeth in my mouth, because I slept on street corners, blacked out, and I didn't know how I had gotten there, you know, because I had blood on my jeans and holes in my jeans where I'd fallen down the night before. It wasn't fashionable in 82 to wear holes in your jeans. You know, I put them there. I'd gotten them there. And I, that's why I came to AA, because I had lost my click. I had lost my fix. I had lost what was vital to me. It was like Colin said, you know, alcohol was amazing, man. I mean, what it did for me was amazing. It was simply, it was my life depended on it. I had to have a right to drink. I thought AA was about learning how to drink again. I couldn't imagine life without that. And so, you know, I mean, that's what I came to AA for. Now, what has happened is I'm 31 years sober. My son is 27 years old. And even if he never drinks, I've got more time than him. And he is my best friend. And he's a good buddy. And it's just amazing, that relationship I have with him. But he came to live with me when he was 5 years old. And I was asked to tell this story. And if you hate speaker meetings like me, I'm going to tell you in about the next 2 minutes, I can tell you my story. And now you don't have to stay for the meeting. You know what I mean? I can tell you in 2 minutes, this is my story. And I'm always asked to share this. And it came to me when my son used to come in. He came to live with me when he was 5. And every Saturday morning, he'd wake up and he'd watch these Saturday morning cartoons. You know? And he loved to watch these cartoons. And there was this one cartoon that he watched at 7:30 every Saturday morning. He loved it. It was the Roadrunner cartoon. He used to come on. He had the bird that goes beep, beep. Actually, it goes meep, meep. It was meep, meep. And it had a mad dog in it, too. His name was Wiley. It was Wiley Coyote and this Roadrunner. And, you know, I had my friend Jimmy on the phone, and we'd be talking, trying to figure out how to make pancakes for our kids, you know, watching this cartoon in the background. And we looked at it one morning, and we figured one of us must have written this thing. Because in it, there is this coyote, there is this wily coyote, and he is not happy, you know. He's having a very bad day. He is irritable, restless, and discontented. He is not a happy coyote. He's not a happy dog, you know. And he is, and in one of the earliest episodes, you see that he actually catches a roadrunner and he eats it and it fixes him. It is amazing. It is like he has got an immediate sense of ease and comfort. He eats this bird and he's okay. You know, it immediately fixes him. It's like a spiritual experience. He ate that bird. It's like Bugs Bunny Day. He knows. He knows how to talk to people. Things don't baffle him anymore. So Wiley is now going to spend the rest of his life buying Acme rockets, strapping them to roller skates, running his head into the side of mountains, you know. Falling 500 feet to his certain death, breaking every bone in his body multiple times on the off chance that he gets one more bite of Roadrunner. I don't know about you, but that's my story. There's nothing more to say about it, man. I mean, that is it. And in this cartoon, it was amazing, you know. Every episode would end the same way. There'd be this coyote, he'd be beat up, you know. He'd have a black eye, and he'd have a bandage on his head. And he'd have his arm in a sling, and he'd have his leg in a cast. He'd be on a crutch and one roller skate. You know, and he'd be going after this bird. And the bird would move at the last second, and he'd roll off the edge of the cliff. And he'd look down, and he'd defy gravity for about 2 seconds, where he's going to fall to a certain death. And before he fell, he'd look at the camera with his black eye, you know. And he'd smile, this huge smile. And he whipped out a sign, and the sign said, "Genius." And then he'd fall to his death, you know. You know, that's, there is a message of depth and weight in that. I want to tell you, you know, I thought, my 5-year-old can't even read the word genius. I mean, this is not for kids, you know. This is, you know, we get very serious about this. I remember asking Cubby about, he said, "Yeah, man, you know, there's a definite message in that." But,
To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
There it is. That's my story. There's the coyote story. I promised I would tell that, so I told that story. Here comes the real one. I'm from Beaumont, Texas, originally. Beaumont is 90 miles east of Houston. It's about 5 miles west of Louisiana state line. And the significance of that is when I was 14 years old, it was 1967, so it makes me 61, I don't know. It makes me old, you know what I mean? And I was 14 in 1967, and in the state of Texas, in 1967, you could get a legal driver's license at the age of 14. You couldn't drink until you're 21, but you could get a driver's license at 14. Now, in Louisiana, you could drink at 18. But you didn't drive till you're 18, but you could drink at 18. We were 5 miles from Louisiana, so if you were old enough to drive in that state, they didn't even check your ID, you know. They just sold you the booze. I've never been to a liquor store in Louisiana that didn't have a drive-through window. They're all like a Jack in the Box or McDonald's at night, you know. You just pull up to the window and you order what you want. You don't even have to get out of the car. You know, and my dad had given me his old 58 Chevy Delray. It was a tank of a car, and it was his old work car, and he had given that to me, and I had this license, and I had this car, and I was 14, so I got to hang out with guys who were older than me. These guys were all 16 to 18, and because I had a car, you know, I got in. There was six of them, there was one of me, and we called ourselves the Magnificent Seven of Beaumont, you know. And we would pile in that car and we'd drive over the 5 miles over the state line into Vinton, Louisiana. We come up upon the first liquor store. It was called Jack's Packet. It was a big red neon sign on the side of the road. I can see it in my mind's eye to this day. It said liquor, and it flashed liquor, and I thought, yeah, baby, I mean, this was, it might as well have been Vegas to me. You know, I mean, we had seven guys in that car, and we'd pull up, and we'd go around back. They used to put oyster shells in the driveways in Louisiana to keep you from, because you were underwater, mostly. And I could hear the tires crackling on these oyster shells as I pulled into this liquor store. And there'd be a 300-pound guy, he'd stick his head out the window, the drive-thru window, you know, he'd have no hair on his head, he'd have a cigar hanging out of his mouth, he'd say, "What can we do for you boys?" And we'd buy Boone's Farm apple wine. We bought this Boone's Farm strawberry wine. You know, my favorite was for $1.59, you could get a huge green gallon jar of Bally High wine. Had a little hula girl on the label. She'd be dancing. She was the sexiest thing I'd ever seen. I mean, I could draw a picture of her, too, for you. I mean, it was just amazing, this stuff. And I was convinced it was like a marketing ploy. You drink that whole bottle, that's how you say, "I'm very high. I'm Bally High." And we'd have enough money left over to get one ticket into Showtown USA drive-in movie theater. So we'd pile six guys into the trunk of this car. The rear end be dragging on the ground, making sparks, you know. And here's this one little kid driving with all this booze in the back seat. We'd go out there and we'd meet the girls, and that was it. You know, that was the beginning. It was a high I chased for years. It was just amazing. I mean, the significance of it was that for me as a kid in Texas, there was two things. It was football and it was Jesus in the state of Texas, in that order. And I didn't want anything to do with either one. You know, I didn't want anything to do with either one. And what they told me was, they said, "This is a wrong thing for me to be doing." They said, "You're not supposed to be drinking this stuff. It's not good for you." But I'll tell you what it did for me was just amazing. Cubby used to say, "When what it does for you, you know, is greater than what it does to you, and you're in trouble." And that was the case with me. I mean, what it did for me was just miraculous, you know. It showed me how to get along with those guys. It had me be a part of the conversation. I knew how to talk to the girls when I drank that stuff. I mean, it was amazing. It was like it was a secret to life. It was how you became a grown-up, was you drank this stuff and you could act. Who couldn't act, you know, in a mature way now? Who couldn't figure things out without this? It was everything to me. And it was a miracle what it did for me. When I was 19, I was 18, ran away. I went to New York City. I got a job in New York City driving cab for Bell Garage in the South Bronx on Fordham Road. I worked there until I was 21. My dad died. When I was 21, my sister, who was 6 years older than me, called me up and she said, "You got to come bury your father." And I hadn't talked to him for 3 years. And then when I was 25, my sister, who was on a Fulbright scholarship to the University of Cologne in Germany, had a three-year-old. And she contracted a type C hepatitis. They didn't know what that was back then. She came in and out of a coma. And after about 9 months, she had an aneurysm. And I went home and I held her son in my arms while my mother buried her daughter, and I swore off God. I thought, if anybody's supposed to be dead in this deal, it was me and not her, because I was continually looking for bigger and better highs. And here she was dead and I was doing okay. And that made no sense to me. I thought, if there's a God, I want nothing to do with him. You know, and I got a job in Los Angeles right after that. From New York, I went to L.A., and I had to make a lot of money in a little bit of time. And by now, I was a blackout drinker. Every time I drink, I lose 3 and 4 days of my life. I drink on like a Thursday, and next thing I know, it'd be Monday. And one time I came to walking downtown Scottsdale. So how did I get here? I don't know to this day how I got to Scottsdale, Arizona. If you knew and you're looking to go back out there, God bless you, but And especially if you knew and you didn't stand up at the beginning of the meeting, that was me. That's who you're welcome here. And we got you. It'll still work. But if you're new and you're a blackout drinker like I was, in the old days they used to have newsstands. And they were lifesavers because top 2 inches of a newspaper will tell you everything you need to know. It'll tell you what day it is and where you are. That's what I did. I went by a newsstand. I looked down. Oh, it's Scottsdale. Sunday. How did I get here? You know. It was a week before Thanksgiving in 1982. We were going to go to a party, and the party had to start. You know, you couldn't go to a, you had to get ready to go to a party. Couldn't go to a party conscious. You had to go to a party, you had to be ready to go to the party. And so the party, we started getting ready to go to the party about 3 in the afternoon. Party's 10 o'clock that night. I'm staying with a girlfriend, and all she has to drink, and she's out of town. She's gone, but all she had to drink was this bottle of gin. She had a bottle of Tanqueray gin. And I hated gin, but it's all she had, and we had to get ready to go to the party. And so we, last thing I remember was about 3 in the afternoon, I pulled down 2 water glasses, I put them out there, started to fill them full of this gin. I don't even remember taking the first drink. That was on a Thursday. Next thing I know, it is Monday morning. I am lying face down on the southeast corner of Hollywood and Vine. There's a Starbucks there now. So I guess it's Sunset and Vine. And no, it was Hollywood. Hollywood and Vine, the bar was. And I'm lying face down, and people are walking over me and looking at me like I used to look at the bums on the subway. And I'm thinking, how'd I get here? You know, I mean, it was like I didn't know. I was a dog on the freeway. I was useless. I was a road hazard. I didn't know how I got there. Cubby used to say, he said he was a scream looking for a mouth. And that was me that morning. And the scream was, this isn't me. You're not seeing me. This isn't who I am. I'm not supposed to be here. This is not supposed to be happening to me. And yet I couldn't, none of that would come out of my mouth, and these people were looking at me and walking over me, and I thought I was panicked. I was in terror. And I came to on that street corner, and back then they used to have these black boxes on the street. You put money in them, you could make a phone call. They were called pay phones. I had explained to my 27-year-old son what a pay phone was, you know, I mean. And so I came to that morning, and I had blood on my eyes, I had loose teeth in my mouth, I had blood on my face, blood on my hands. I was looking for some money. I had this old army jacket on. I was looking through the pockets. I had found 37 cents. And there was a payphone hanging there, and I found in my pocket, I found this piece of yellow legal pad. It was like a corner of a legal pad torn off. The yellow piece of paper, and it said Michael, and it had a phone number on it. And I found this in my pocket, and I recognized the handwriting. I used to bartend with this guy. He had a very distinctive handwriting. And I could tell from the way he had spelled his name, I knew who it was. And I remember seeing this guy for the first time in a couple of years. We used to bartend together in New York. And I'd seen him at a bar in L.A., a few weeks before that, you know, maybe a couple of months before that. And he'd been drinking this Perrier. And I walked up to him and I said, hey, Michael, I hadn't seen you forever. He said, yeah. I said, let me buy you a drink. He said, no, I hadn't had a drink in a year and a half. I said, that's terrible, man. I mean, why would you do that to yourself, you know? Let me buy you a drink, you know? And he said, no, I've been going to AA. Well, that was the end of that conversation. That name, I guess in my blackout that night, he had written his number down and slipped it in the pocket of that jacket. I don't know to this day how I got there, but he had that number. It was that number in my pocket, and I found it there that morning. And because of the state I was in was one of utter, I was at a bottom, and I didn't even know it, you know, but I was not going to, I wasn't thinking, you know, I just had this quarter in my hand, there was a payphone there, and there was a number, and I called it, and he said, "Where are you?" And I told him what must have been about 20 minutes, but felt like 2 minutes to me. He comes pulling up in his car, he throws open the door, we get in the car, he takes me in my first AA meeting. Now, I knew nothing about this deal. You know, I walked into that meeting. How do you approach a dog on a freeway? You know, if you're going to go get a dog on a freeway, you better be shooting straight. You better be coming from the heart and telling the truth. And these people were looking at me and they said things. They said things like, "We're glad you're here." You know, that statement to me that morning in the condition I was in didn't make any sense. Why would anybody be glad I was anywhere? You know, they said, "We're glad you're here." And the guy who said it seemed to be telling the truth. He was looking me square in the eye and he was smiling. He says, "Your friend Michael sits there. Why don't you sit here next to him?" He said, "What do you want in your coffee?" And he had a Brooklyn accent. And so I told him, I said, "I like it light, no sugar." And I thought, if he's from Brooklyn, he'll know what that means. And he went to get my coffee. And I told my friend Michael, I said, "You know, this guy spotted me. Can you spot me a cup of coffee? You know, I spent my last quarter calling you, and this guy just asked me where I wanted my coffee. He said, 'The coffee's for free.' I said, 'I'm impressed.'" I mean, I couldn't believe, you know, it was unbelievable to me what was happening. It was surreal. It was surreal that you'd find a room like this with people that would have nothing to do with a guy like you, and yet they were all seemed to be attentive and glad that I was there. Didn't make any sense. You know what it was? It was a message of depth and weight. It was a message. It wasn't what they said. It wasn't what was written in their book. It wasn't even what they, you know, it wasn't specifically what they did. It was just who they were. It was how they were. It was where I was. You know, when I was in that room and I saw, you know, this fellowship and its acceptance of me, I mean, it was compelling. I would argue with everything you say. I didn't want anything to do with your book. But I wasn't going to not come to your next meeting. I mean, I was compelled, man. It kept me coming back. It was a very powerful. At the end of that meeting, there was a guy with a Brooks Brothers suit on. He was in the meeting. He was dressed to the nines, this guy. Now, he didn't look like anybody to have anything to do with a guy like me. And it was a pretty big meeting, and he was across the room, and he had this red carnation in his lapel, and in this Brooks Brothers suit dressed, and I thought, who is this? You know, and this guy, he's all the way across the room at the end of this meeting, he yells out, he said, "Michael," he said, "don't go anywhere, I want to meet your friend Frank." And I thought, okay, here it is. I thought the guy's a narc, you know. Somebody's dropped a dime, you know. And he comes running across the room, he sticks his hand out, and he says, "My name's Bob." And I said, "Bob." And he said, "When's your next meeting?" And I said, "There are other meetings, I didn't know." And he said, "Yes, there's one tonight at 7 o'clock. And he says, "I'm going to be there, your friend Michael's going to be there, why don't you join us?" And I thought, what do I have, plans? You know, I don't So I said, okay, you know, I guess I just nodded my head. I was standing there, and he's walking away, and it's like he'd forgotten his briefcase or something. He reached down to get his briefcase, snaps his fingers, he looks at his watch, and he says, "Wait a second." And this scared me, you know. I thought, oh, here it goes, you know. And he says, "It's 2 o'clock right now." He says, "That meeting's not till 7 tonight." He says, "You're not going to drink between now and then, are you?" And I guess I took too long answering that question. Because he goes off and he gets like three of the guys together. He makes a phone call. And he called into work, I found out later on, because something more important had come up. And there were four of the other guys, and they got me together, and they took me to this coffee shop called Figueroa's. They set me on the inside of the booth, and there was a sentinel that went on for the next 4 hours. And they walked me to that meeting at 7:30 that night, and they made sure I didn't drink, and they made sure that I understood that I didn't know what a priority was. I didn't know what first was. They did. They said, we know what number one is, and if you'll do what we tell you, all these 192,000 problems you got are going to disappear. You know, he said. They said, you just don't leave a meeting without knowing when and where your next meeting is. And then you stay conscious between the meetings. You know, it's, what a concept, you know. It seemed pretty simple. The next morning, I went to another meeting, and these guys that were greeting me there, they recognized me from the day before, and I barely recognized them, but they knew that I had stayed conscious for that day, you know. And it gave me that much self-esteem, you know, one day's worth. It was really, it's a message of depth and weight, and it's amazing what we have here. The steps worked me. I'm going to tell you real quick this story, and then I get down. I've got to tell you what I mean by that. The steps worked me because it took me 2 years to read that book. And if you're new here and you have a hard time participating and you have a hard time with the God part, then I want to tell you this story because that was me. That was me. And it took me 2 years to read the book. But by the time I read about the steps in the book, it was a history lesson because the fellowship and going to the meetings, they had all worked me. The steps worked me. I didn't have to work them. I mean, for the most part. Yeah, I had to go back and clean up some stuff, but this is a story about that. I mean, I was 90 days sober, and I hadn't taken any chips. I'd never raised my hand as a newcomer. I wouldn't hold hands at the end of the meeting during the Lord's Prayer. I'd never stood anywhere that my back wasn't against the wall. I mean, I just wasn't participating. And it was because I was just too terrified. It was too much for me. And I had 90 days, and my friend, in 90 days, my friend Michael had come up to me, and he said, listen, man, he says, you got to take a chip. You got to take a chip for 90 days, because he says, there's plenty of people with less time than that, and you'll really make a difference for them if you'll take a chip. And I thought, 90 days, 90 days is a long time. Ask anybody with 89 days. They'll tell you. 90 days is a long time without a drink. You know, so I thought, okay, I'm going to do it. I'm going to take this chip. I'm going to participate. And I went to this one meeting that gave chips. My friend Ken over here, he used to go to that meeting. It was a Wednesday noon meeting at Yucca and Gower. And there was a guy named Irv Neamy. And he sat on the front left of that meeting. He sat in the same chair every week. And there were maybe 150 people that go there. And you had to get there early to get a seat. Because if you didn't, you didn't get a seat, you know. And you had to have a seat in order to take a chip. So I got there early, and I put my keys down on my seat. I'm going up the aisle, and Irv, this is Irv's meeting. Irv got sober. You know, Irv had, Irv died in 89 with over 30 years of sobriety. He got sober like with the dinosaurs or something. And this guy had been sober forever. You know, everybody knew who Irv was. You know, I knew guys that knew guys that knew Irv. But I had never talked to Irv. And he sat on the front left of that meeting, and I'm saving my seat, and I'm walking up the aisle, and who's coming the other way but Irv Neamy. And it's just him by himself, and he's looking me square in the eye, and he stops, and he says, hey, how you doing? Now, I got to tell you, that's like God asking you how. I thought, nobody's around. Irv Neamy wants to know how I'm doing. I got to tell him the truth. So I said, I'm not doing too good. And he said, excuse me? I said, yeah, I've been going to these stupid meetings for 90 days, man. Nothing's getting any better. I'm in thousands of dollars worth of debt to the wrong kind of people. I used to bartend and deal drugs, and I can't do that anymore. I still got a car, but I couldn't find my car. I lost it in a blackout. It took me 6 months to find my car. My girlfriend had the keys. I hadn't lost the keys. But she wouldn't pick up the phone, so I couldn't drive it even if I did find it. And I'm sleeping on my friend's couch. Nothing's getting any better. I'm coming to these stupid meetings, and I'm pathetic, you know? How are you? And Irv, he's not even looking at me at this point. He's looking in the back of the room. He says, you know that guy back there? I turned and I said, no. And it was a guy back there, and he had about a 2-foot stack of aluminum ashtrays. And he's dropping them all over the place. And this is back when people used to smoke in meetings. So they had an ashtray commitment. And he said, that guy's Jeff. That guy's name's Jeff. You know, Irv, this old timer, he's looking at me. He says, yeah, that guy in the back of the room, his name's Jeff. And he's got about 2 minutes to put all those ashtrays out. Why don't you go give him a hand? Now, let's review this for a second. You know? By now, there are people standing around listening to this conversation, and I'm embarrassed. You embarrass me, I'll kill you. You know, with 90 days, I mean, I couldn't handle being embarrassed. You know, and I said, and I thought, you know, I wanted to reach out and touch Irv, you know. And I thought, I got to get out of this, you know. And yet, you know, what happened was without a thought. I thought I could run for the door. I could reach out and touch Irv. I can't do that. And it was a third option. It was to go ask the guy, where'd you get these stupid ashtrays? I'm supposed to help you with them. Where are they? He says, they're back in the kitchen. I went back in the kitchen. There was a guy back there with an army jacket on. He had a Duncan Butterfly yo-yo. It was a Duncan Butterfly trick yo-yo. Now, the story of that is that when I was 12 years old in Beaumont, Texas, I had won a Briggs & Stratton mini bike doing a yo-yo trick called Walk the Dog, further than any other kid in my age group. And this guy in the kitchen, I mean, it's like I hadn't seen a yo-yo in 20 years. It's like riding a bike. You never forget how. This guy in the kitchen couldn't even make it go up and down, man. I mean, that'll break your heart, you know. So I walked over to him, I said, I'm going to show you how to do this yo-yo, man. You can't, where'd you get a Duncan Butterfly? This is amazing. Went out in the courtyard, I'm doing Around the Worlds and Rock the Cradle. I could do a Star of Texas while it spun, you know. He said, that's amazing. He said, my name's Bill. I said, I'm Frank. He said, how you doing? I said, I'm glad you asked me. No. I said, do you know Irv? He said, everybody knows Irv. Everybody knows. I said, these old-timers, they don't care. You know, they just, he's a mean guy, Irv, you know. Anyway, I told him how I was doing. Make a long story short, this guy with the yo-yo gives me his business card. I called him that afternoon. I went to work for him the next day. I met my future business partner, which has led me to a career that has raised my son and fed my face for over 30 years. Took me getting a year cake at that same meeting with the guy with the yo-yo sitting next to me to nudge me and say to me, he says, you realize we would have never met if you hadn't gone to put out those ashtrays. What did Irv know? I mean, it is an amazing thing. In the very beginning of this talk, I said, there is evidence, there is tremendous evidence in these meetings and in this fellowship that we are all connected, that it all has the secrets here. And, you know, there's days I wake up and I tell, you know, I scream at the heavens and I say, why don't you reveal yourself to me? Because I need to know you're here today, you know, and yet it always will happen, not on my time, but there will always be some kind of miracle. Something that you know would have never come to pass had I not just hung out one more day with you. You know, what you do is you give me an opportunity to find out where the secret is. The secret is that if I'm here to help you, I cannot help but help myself. You know, I am broken. But with you, if I see myself as a fixed person, if I see how you're doing, and I just look and see who's dropping ashtrays in the back of the room. Go give them a hand. You know, then I get to experience my completion while they can experience theirs. You know, it is amazing. It's an amazing journey. It's an amazing thing we have here. It's a message of depth and weight. Go live it. We're not a glum lot. Have fun and dance your butts off tonight. Okay, thank you.
We hope you've enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.